across Northern Ireland, on your radio, and on BBC Sounds. This is The Stephen Nolan Show!
Hello everyone, welcome to this podcast from the BBC. We're talking about transport, we're talking about traffic yet again at the top of the show today. We're talking about Brexit and the Irish Sea border on the programme today. And Jude White from the Welcome Centre comes in announcing a whole new centre opening up very, very soon for homeless people. And the incredible work we discuss that the Welcome Centre and other charities are doing for some of the most vulnerable people in our society. Hope you enjoy the programme today. The Stephen Nolan Show! You had another programme this week where the Nolan Show concentrates on our public transport network, how we move around the city, and just as importantly, how we get involved. And we've listened to Minister O'Dowd, Mr. John O'Dowd, tell us that, look, he's up for the challenge, he's up for debate, and he wants us to feed into the conversation around how we improve our lives, how we improve the gridlock. And that means, he says, buying in to public transport. That means buying into thinking about leaving our car behind and getting onto a bus or a train. Because as more and more cars are on the roads and the roads aren't getting any bigger, then the situation is only going to get worse. So very much, John O'Dowd saying, look, work with me here and get on a bus and get on a train if you can. So the obvious question is there leadership at the top? Is Minister O'Dowd himself, he's disclosed that he has a Belfast City Centre office, which he goes to around 2 days a week. So does Minister O'Dowd, we asked, use a bus himself to get into the office in Belfast City Centre? And the department refusing to be clear on that, refusing to give a clear answer. And therefore, our government minister refusing to tell any of you, despite asking you to do it yourselves, whether he does it. The Department of Infrastructure told the newsletter the minister uses public transport when it is practical for him to do so. So no clear answer as to whether the man asking you to do it is doing it himself. The Irish News went back to them. By the way, we asked the questions and they just failed to respond to you through us. Department of Infrastructure were asked to elaborate further by the Irish News. And so they came back with this from the department. The minister works in the city centre at most 2 days a week, working the other days either in the assembly, out and about, in visits or remotely. By limiting his trips into the city centre, the minister avoids adding to the congestion. So is that the answer? Don't go near the city centre to stop adding to the congestion. So clearly, John not able to say, well, look, I go into the city centre and here's how many days a week when I go in, I use public transport. And then they say, due to the confidential and often highly sensitive nature of ministerial and executive business, public transport is not usually a viable option for ministerial travel. When the minister can use public transport, he does so. So look, you know, a government minister with all of that information that one of our ministers will have, does anybody expect him to be on a bus? Well, that then begs the question, does anybody expect doctors to be on a bus? Does anybody expect teachers to be on a bus and all the GDPR around the information that they'll have with children? Our social workers, our NHS workers, lots of us have sensitive information. Can't we keep it in a briefcase until we get into the office? So what is Minister O'Dowd saying? What is the Department of Infrastructure saying? Anybody with sensitive data shouldn't get on a bus? Of course they're not saying that. If he's making confidential phone calls, or many other people in all different walks of life get into their jobs, are making confidential phone calls. So it seems that the minister, who's asking all of you to use public transport when getting into Belfast, doesn't do it himself. And it also seems that he's choosing to stay out of Belfast City Centre when he's on his way to work. Because the statement says, by limiting his trips into the city centre, the minister avoids adding to the congestion. So he's not staying out, but he's limiting his trips. So look, there's a little bit around that. Why don't we see leadership from the top? How many of our permanent secretaries, how many of the people who are ruling your lives, who are deciding to tell you to use it, are using it themselves? Then as part of this conversation around the cycle lanes, which we all see, again, let's buy into it. Let's start discussing it properly. They won't tell you how often they're being used. So despite them promising to do so, and this was when we had a guest with us 2 days ago, who was the head of roads at Belfast, at the Department of Infrastructure. They just won't tell you. They won't tell you how often the cycle lanes are being used. This was Colin Woods who promised you that we would get the data, and the Department of Infrastructure are now failing to release the data. So what we will try to do on your behalf is we'll try to squeeze it out. We'll try to squeeze it out. It's Colin Woods, by the way. So we'll try to squeeze it out of them by putting in a Freedom of Information request around the use of bus lanes, and we'll try to give you the information since the department are now choosing not to release it to you. But what we want to do is we want to be part of this wider conversation. And look, to be fair to John O'Dowd, he has said he wants that too. 03030805555. Mr. Conway is the head of TransLink. He was on Evening Extra last night, and he was asked why people would ditch the car when some bus services are not reliable.
There's lots of options. People are aware of the congestion and the types of issues. And, you know, if you use your car, you're going to be sitting in a long queue of traffic as well. So I think it's about, you know, people planning their journey. You know, public transport, using our journey planner, for example, plan your journey and stay a little later in the evening if you can. And if you can, come in a little bit earlier. If you can use public transport, please try to use public transport. We appreciate that's not suitable for everyone. We need about a shift, to put it in reality, you need a shift of about 20% reduction in cars. So it's not that everyone needs to get out of the cars, but we do need to see that shift.
So 20%. So again, let's think about that. 20% of us ditching the car. So can they incentivize us by making public transport cheaper? Can they make it more reliable? Can TransLink promise to stop telling us that things are blissful when we know they're not? What do you do, for example, if you're on your way to work and some of the services just are not punctual? They're just not turning up on time. How many bosses are going to be flexible and understanding? If you're a nurse on your way to work and the bus doesn't turn up, Mr. Conway is acknowledging and conceding that there are punctuality problems at peak time traffic at night time. Well, what if you're on a night shift on the way to hospital? What do the patients do? What if you're a plumber, an electrician, and you have to try to get the bus somewhere? What if you're going to the international airport and, like they did the other day, they cancelled 14 services? Where's your holiday go? There's no refund. And that is also about the stock, the amount of buses, to be fair to TransLink, that they have when one breaks down. So are we prepared to put more money in? Chris Conway was asked, does the scale of disruption being caused by the road closures around Grand Central Station reflect what his modelling told him would happen?
You know, the modelling around Grand Central Station and Durham Street was only one, you know, we were only modelling the impact of that. As we've heard, there's been impacts on lots of other things across the city, which is causing congestion. And you've got to put it into the whole issue. You've also got to recognise we're at Christmas time as well. So that is adding to the issue. So we've got to let that settle down into the new year. As well as that, behaviours change and patterns change as well as time goes by.
Wasn't Christmas time in November when we were all sitting stuck in the traffic? Wasn't Christmas time in October either? Chris Conway pointed to the glider service and suggested more continuous bus lanes in Belfast could tackle congestion.
Glider is a good example where we've implemented Glider. And one of the things that makes Glider successful is it has more continuous bus lanes, and therefore it makes its punctuality and reliability better. And I think we need to, you know, the bus lanes that we have in Belfast were designed back in 2012 with the beginning of Belfast on the Move. And we probably need to review that again and look at more continuous bus lanes to make bus passengers' journeys easier and during times of congestion. Now, I know that's controversial because that will reduce road space as well.
So what about that? And look, I know it's controversial, taking even more road away from motorists. But if that meant that the buses glided through the city, not like their ads are suggesting they do, but if it actually happened, what about that? Would that be game-changing for our city? Would we support that? 030 30 80 55 55. Chris McCracken, Managing Director at Linen Quarter. Morning to you, Chris.
Good morning, Stephen.
Look, you know, we're getting hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of calls into this programme every day about this. And it's got to be more than us just complaining about it. So what about, for example, more bus lanes? Continuous bus lanes?
Well, I think the sad thing, Stephen, is about 10 years ago, a lot of plans were put in place to alleviate all of these problems and predict what would happen where we are today. But because of the fall of the Assembly for 5 years, because 2 or 3 years lost from COVID, none of those plans were put into place. So one plan was the North-South glider, for example. Now, that would take 105 people off the road for every glider going down. That's equivalent to a kilometre of cars. So if we had that North-South glider with a dedicated bus lane, as you're suggesting, that would reduce congestion. Another idea from 2015 was to have multi-storey car parks around the city centre. So people are going to drive in. We're a rural society outside of Belfast. People still need their cars, but they don't need to drive right into the very heart of the city centre unless you're disabled, and then there's disabled parking given for you. But those multi-storey car parks would allow you to drive into Belfast, park at the outskirts of the city centre, and then walk, cycle, or take a short bus ride into the city centre. So there's practical things that we can do, but we're now 10 years behind the curve and with a lot of catching up to do.
And look, there's the short term and there's the long term, isn't there, as to what we do to help. I said yesterday, I'm not sure there should be this presumption that motorists are put at the bottom of the pile. That should be part of a democratic discussion, should it not? There's this presumption, well, motorists have got to get on a bus. Motorists have got to sit in traffic. Minister O'Dowd's talking about expect congestion if you're in a car. Well, why should society automatically accept that a cycle lane should be there if the Department of Infrastructure, for example, won't even tell the public how often those cycle lanes are being used, despite their head of roads telling us they would release that information? They just haven't.
No, you absolutely need a balanced proposal for this. It's not about saying people can't drive into the city centre, but the problem is about 70% of traffic going into the city is cars, and it's just too many for the network. Our car registrations is growing about 2 or 3% every single quarter. It's unsustainable. Every other city will have mass public transport. So that is gliders, it's trams, it's light railways, taking people in and out of the city. And the test for a successful public transport is whenever people that are wealthy, people that are influential, people that can afford to have a chauffeur, ditch all that and still prefer to take public transport because it's so quick, it's so cheap and it's so efficient. And that does bring to an issue around cost. A lot of people are saying, look, it's just too expensive to do. Now, I think I have a lot of sympathy for that. I think we do need to reduce cost on public transport. We need a higher subsidy. The minister has said he doesn't have the money to do that. So we need to look at other revenue-raising measures that will support a subsidy for public transport.
The public sector in Northern Ireland and each of these government departments are huge. So let me bring Brian Smith into this, Green Party councillor. Morning to you, Brian.
Good morning, Stephen.
So I was just mid-sentence there. The public sector is huge, absolutely colossal in Northern Ireland, right? Mm-hmm. So they could take the lead here. And if they're telling private employers what to do, and if they're telling private citizens what to do, each of these departments could create the template themselves. So we asked the Department of Infrastructure, are they asking staff to work from home at least one day a week to help alleviate traffic congestion in Belfast city centre? And you get this broad, it doesn't answer the question in detail response. In common with other departments, Department of Infrastructure has hybrid working arrangements in place. So Stephen, one day a week, they don't answer it. And then they're asking Stephen, the public to buy into this.
Stephen, I had someone contact me who works in the civil service, who stated that they found it a bit rich that the minister is asking people to come in. Work at home when civil service is trying to encourage people to get back in the office. So I do think there needs to be a consistency of message right across the departments. But I think that this has touched on some of the issues here. I think that public transport has always lagged behind. We've never taken it seriously. There's been a quarter of a million cars on the road in Northern Ireland in 1971 at the census end.
Unfortunately, Bram, we'll see if we can get your phone fixed. First call of the day is James in Temple Patrick. Morning, James.
Morning, Stephen.
Good morning.
As a community group in Temple Patrick, we met with the road service, and we've been saying to them that the number of cars that are parking in park and rides and park and shares and going to the airport and abandoning their cars for 2, 3, and in some cases 10 weeks while they go away on holidays, is actually restricting people to be able to park and actually get a public transport bus. So if the road service were to put some like 24-hour restrictions on some of these park and rides and park and shares, more people would be able to get the bus.
So why do you think that's not happening?
Well, because the road service are not really interested in helping people get on by saying, well, look, you know, it's a car park, let them use it. And in some cases, there's commercial arrangements between the airport and TransLink. That means that people won't pick up at certain park and rides and take them to the airports as well. So there's a whole pile of stuff around the way people use the park and rides and park and shares around the country. There are people parking in Temple Patrick and getting a bus to Dublin because it's cheaper and freer. That just doesn't make sense. And if there was a 24-hour restriction saying you can only park in a park and ride or a park and share for 24 hours, lots more people could use that car park and get a bus into Belfast and prevent them driving in, which at the moment they can't do.
James, thank you. Good morning to you. Back to Brian Smith, Green Party councillor. Morning again, Brian.
Good morning, Stephen. I hope you can hear me now.
One of the questions I'm trying to pose this morning is that, surely there would not be any government department or the government collective in Northern Ireland which is telling the little people to do one thing and they're not. So we've got a situation this morning where Minister O'Dowd is not able to cite any frequency with which he uses public transport. He's not able to tell people when he goes to work how many times a week he uses a bus.
And then,
because we don't want to just make this about Minister O'Dowd, The actual department that is responsible for all this public messaging, they're not able to tell us that they're asking their staff to work one day a week from home, as they asked all of the rest of us to consider doing. So what is this about? Is it one rule for a certain type of person and another for others, or what's going on?
Stephen, well, on that matter, I heard from someone who works in the civil service, stating away that it's interesting that O'Dowd is asking people to come into work or work from home one day a week, that the civil service is trying to encourage people back into the office. So there is no consistency on messaging here. I think that there needs to be. But I know Chris, when he spoke at the start, there made some really good points. I think that we're in a position now where things are completely unsustainable. There was 250,000 cars on the road in Northern Ireland in 1871. There's over 1 million now at the last census 2 years ago. We've never taken public transport seriously. We need to look at radical solutions here in terms of how we get people moving. I think an answer in the short term is to reduce cost, because at the minute it is not economically viable for many people. So if a family of four want to head into Belfast City Centre, it's cheaper to get in the car and to drive and pay one car parking fee so than it is to use public transport. There's also an issue in terms of a lack of connectivity. Public transport isn't available when you have to do different sorts of multiple journeys. And as Chris Conway's talked about, and you've talked about as well over the last few days, there's a real issue here with reliability. And our TransLink service at the minute is inconsistent, intermittent, and there's buses being cancelled. I've had a lot of complaints about the number 6 bus route around the Ravenhill and the Craigie. So I think that there's, in the short term, but I do believe that we need to be seriously looking at reducing bus fares over the next month or so to try and get people moving.
The Ulster Unionist Party MLA, Doug Beattie, with us this morning. Morning to you, Doug.
Good morning, Stephen.
Look, you know, we need a bigger conversation here where the public consent to what's being done to them rather than told what's being done to them. Or are we well past that, Doug? And do we just need to accept the car's got to go in a lot of our lives?
Well, look, I think there's many things we need to do, Stephen. We're in a changed world, a changed environment. There's more cars on the roads, and we have to look at this. I mean, if we go back to 2016, strangely enough, after the EU referendum, our party put out a policy paper, and we said that we need to triple the amount of money that goes to infrastructure. So we really need to change that. An idea could be that park and ride could become free. That there's a cost to that, clearly, and that would have to be fine. But the things that we're going to have to do to try and get cars off the road without putting the burden purely onto the persons in the car, and to say to them, get onto public transport when public transport is caught in the same queues as the guy in the car is a difficult one to fix.
Doug, you have a short period of time on this morning. I know you're going to have to do other things. We appreciate your time today. We also want to talk to you about the vote yesterday. The post-Brexit trade arrangements for another 4 years is what MLAs were voting on. The DUP are describing it as a stitch-up. No requirement for cross-community support for the motion.
Yes, and there's a simple argument to that, I suppose, you know, because in October 2019, when they gave tacit support to the protocol, they thought there would be cross-community voting for that, and then that was taken away. So they have an argument there, and they can be disgruntled. But the issue is this: is the protocol existing at all and being amended to the Windsor framework? That's the problem, because the vote yesterday was on Articles 5 to 10 of the Windsor framework. And if yesterday we had voted, say, no, we want them scrapped, they wouldn't disappear straight away. They would stay for 2 years and they would be replaced by a new set of Articles 5 to 10. And we wouldn't know what they were. We wouldn't know if they'd be good or bad for Northern Ireland. So it's a genuine issue, but it goes back to why on earth support the protocol in the first place. It should never have been there. And the Windsor framework has not helped it in any shape or form.
So what do we do now?
Well, look, surely
this is where we are at. Let's make the best of it. Or do you continue to try to dismantle it?
Well, this is the rules where we are now, Stephen, that we didn't get cross-community support for the vote in the Assembly. The government now has to do an independent review of Articles 5 to 10, and that means that Articles 5 to 10 of the protocol will get a level of scrutiny that it's never had before, and we'll see what the outcomes are. What's important for unionist parties to do now is to make sure they feed into that review in a sensible manner. In the meantime, we're going to have to deal with issues such as the new general product safety regulations, which is going to affect mostly small, medium and micro businesses and not for the better. So there's things we're going to have to now do to try and mitigate against some of the issues we're going to have to face.
And is that not a tokenistic pass by the government? It doesn't actually require them to do anything beyond look at it, does it? They don't have to change anything.
No, they don't have to change anything. But remember, if we'd voted against keeping 5 to 10, we could have ended up with 5 to 10, which could have been worse for Northern Ireland. The fact is that we have not been involved in any of this process, any of the political parties. And that's a real shame. And we should have been involved in all of it at the micro level. But we haven't been. So what we have to do now is move forward. The government has to do the independent review. We need to feed into that independent review. And in the meantime, we need to give ideas to the government that can improve Northern Ireland and our place within the United Kingdom. The Ulster Unionist Party has g- given multiple suggestions, and we will continue to do that, and we will do that when the independent review comes out, and we can see where we can move. And the government as well, Stephen, they're looking to change their relationship with the EU. There's ways they can do that so that we as a whole, United Kingdom, can work in tandem as opposed to us being separated off from the rest of our country.
So is the border in the Irish Sea as big as it always was? Has it got bigger?
Yeah, it's not changed. Well, I think it's got bigger to a degree. I think the general product safety regulations makes it even worse, to be honest with you. So it certainly hasn't gone away. Anybody who said that the Irish Sea border had disappeared after the Safeguarding the Union document was produced, you know, they're now looking and saying, look, what on earth was I talking about? Because it simply hasn't. The Irish Sea border is still there. It's going to continue for the next 4 years. We have to look to see what the Labour government is going to do in relation to relationships between the UK and the European Union and the independent review, which we must feed into in a positive way.
Does this not suggest, Doug, how weak all of you are within unionism? That the Irish Sea border, your own words, has got bigger. And you've got the DUP, the Ulster Unionist Party, the TUV. The Irish Sea border's got bigger.
Yeah, well, look.
How weak are you all as a collective? And is it because you won't work with each other?
Well, it's nothing to do with that. The reality is that there was no strategic thinking as far back as Brexit. I remember, Stephen, the day before the Brexit vote, and sorry to push back so far, but the day before the Brexit vote, our MEP, Tim Nicholson, said, if we vote for breakfast, there will Brexit, there will be border checkpoints placed at our ports in Northern Ireland. He was absolutely right, but he was laughed at. And on the 2nd of October 2019, when Arlene Foster said that the protocol was a serious and sensible solution, and Nigel Dawes the next day said that Boris Johnson had brilliantly outmaneuvered the EU, we were the party which was saying, no, you are putting our union at risk by accepting this. The issue is the protocol coming in any shape or form. Now, we said that, but we're not the largest party. We didn't have the influence. We didn't have the MPs in Westminster. That's a fact. Those who did need to take responsibility for what they did. We've been consistent as a party. And I have to say, we've been consistent and we've given ways to deal with the issue. The TUV have been consistent and true to them as well, but maybe in a slightly different way. But what we have to do now is move forward and work together to feed into the independent review of Articles 5 to 10.
And the vast majority of people listening to this, and maybe this is part of your problem within unionism, the vast majority of the public have no baldy what you're talking about when you say Articles 5 to 10. Like, they really don't.
No, absolutely. They probably don't. But then I will still get lots of emails saying I can't get this product from Great Britain to Northern Ireland because of rules that have been brought in by the EU. So I'll still get lots of those from individuals. And you're right, many won't understand it. Many understand it deeply, particularly hauliers, particularly small, micro, medium businesses and big businesses as well. And these are the ones that build our economy. So when we're talking about infrastructure and wanting to feed more money and resources into infrastructure, that requires a stronger economy. And if we're saying that we may end up struggling in the long term with where we are at this moment in time, then people will take notice to it. But I don't blame anybody if they don't understand this. That's my job as a politician to understand this and try and do something that helps alleviate the situation we find ourselves in, because we're in this situation and we were forced into this situation by a Conservative government that we simply shouldn't have been. And we did warn about it, but the truth is we weren't the biggest party and we could do nothing about it.
Doug, thanks very much for coming on this morning. Doug Beattie, Ulster Unionist Party MLA. Morning, Thomas.
Good morning, Stephen. How are you?
I'm all right, thank you. Go ahead, sir.
Thanks for having me on. Yeah, I suppose the conversation's an interesting one. The reality is we are too dependent on cars. The number of trips taken by car under 2 miles, it's like half the journeys under 2 miles in Northern Ireland are taken by car. That's too many. We're clearly very dependent. So we need to invest. And the problem I have with the argument is it becomes an either-or thing. Either you're a motorist, either you take public transport, or you're on the bike, and it doesn't need to be that. I think investment in alternatives gives people the opportunity to make those choices, and you know, and yes, the bus lanes and the more, that means more bus lanes and more cycle lanes, and it means making space for that. But I suppose it comes down to the question of who is the city for? You know, is it a city that we want filled with traffic? I'd contend that the city is for people and making space for people, and that means making sacrifices in terms of taking cars out of the city and investing in alternatives.
What about, look, I've never heard anybody talk about this, and I'm not suggesting it. I'm only saying, look, a decision to discuss. So if the Department of Infrastructure won't release the information they promised they would around cycle lanes, you start to ask yourself why. So why wouldn't they tell us how many cyclists are using the cycle lanes? What impact would it have on both public transport and the private motorist if we got rid of cycle lanes? Like, why should that be completely off even discussing?
I suppose you look at success stories from around the world, and places that have really tackled this well are cities that have invested in active travel infrastructure, where they've made hard decisions to take cars out of the city and invested in cycle lanes that allows people to get on their bikes. And it's not just a cycle lane here and there, which has been the problem in Belfast for so long, but a coherent network of joined up cycling infrastructure that allows people to get right across the city from A to B, that allows them to stay on the bike and not have to contend with traffic.
But they don't, do they? Because the bus lanes aren't continuous. The cycle lanes aren't continuous. And look, I get it, right? That cycle lanes are more than just about easing congestion. It's about safety for cyclists as well. But I think it's a fair question. And the public should not be kept in the dark by the Department of Infrastructure. How many people are using the cycle lanes? Are we not allowed to know?
Data collection is an important one. And again, in the cities that have done it well, there's good sources of data collection. There's counters on lanes. But again, those are in places where there are coherent networks in place. Yeah. In Belfast, it's hard to say someone, you know, understand what journey someone's going on to because of the sheer lack of cycling infrastructure. So people have to go in various different ways. And yeah, I agree. I think we do need data collection. However, we need to invest in a proper infrastructure because that's what the number one problem that stops people cycling is safety. And something that addresses safety is considerable investment in active travel infrastructure so people feel safe enough to do it as a legitimate option.
Well, look, I said it earlier on. We'll say it again this morning just to reassure you. The department have gone quiet, like literally silent, despite their boss saying they would release the cycling data. 2 days later, no response. So what we will do is we'll go back to them today again. If we are unable to bring you that information tomorrow, by them voluntarily releasing that information, we will try to force it out of them through freedom of information. Brian Smith, you could then start thinking to yourself that, look, do we build more cycle lanes? Or if there are fewer cycle lanes, and I know you'll probably be against this, Do we start to think, well, could that be an extra bus lane? Or could that provide more width in the road? Why are we presuming things have to stay as they are, is what I'm saying.
I think, Stephen, as I said earlier, there's now over 1 million cars on the road. That's gone up from 250,000 in 1971. Where we're at is completely unsustainable long term. I've heard some people talking about expanding the road network. You look at somewhere like LA, they expand the road network, more cars go on the road. This can't continue. So we need to be looking at joined up multiple solutions. Cycling is one in terms of a lot of journeys in Belfast under 2 miles. We need to make it safe. And Stephen, I would argue that a white lane at the side of a road does not constitute a safe cycle lane. I live just off the Ravenhill Road. I would not cycle down parts of the Ravenhill Road.
So if it's not safe, what's it there for at all?
Stephen, I asked the department, I asked them a year or so ago, what about vans, work vans, cars, etc., that are blocking those lanes? Would they not be ticketed? And they told me that they were classed as advisory cycle lanes. They weren't proper. They were advisory. So if you want to be serious here, we have to build segregated, safe cycling routes. We also have to look at expansion of public transport. Translink got, I think it was 15% less than what they asked for. I think it accounts to £160 million less than their budget this year. We've never taken public transport seriously. It's always been the poor relations, and now we are at gridlock and chaos in the city centre. As much as John O'Dowd doesn't want us to use the word chaos, that's where we're at. there is an economic issue here. Yes, of course, some people are going to need to go by car. Tradespeople, etc., are going to need to use their vans. We don't want to impinge on people. We're having an economic, impact. But for many of us, could, if there was a joined up, proper, reliable, connected public transport system, I think many people would start to move towards that. We've seen it in other places. And again, I want to just knock this on the head with cycling. Copenhagen and Amsterdam were where we are at now, 40, 50 years ago. 40% of the journeys into Copenhagen are done by bicycle. This is not a dream. This is not something. This is not some sort of utopia. It can be done if there is a serious political and policy will. And also, as you say, that we have these open and honest conversations with the public and bring them along.
Well, I heard John, and to be fair to him, he did. So, you know, Minister O'Dowd's under a degree of pressure at the moment. And to be fair to him, what he said to William Crawley on Talkback yesterday, he said he's up for that. He said if you take a ministerial job, you're up for challenge, and that's what John said, and he said, look, he wants a respectful conversation around it. How respectful is it, though, that we don't know some of the detail around our lives in terms of the cycle lanes they're trying not to tell you, in terms of the minister? Like, the minister hasn't even been able to disclose any day, anywhere, where he's used public transport. Why not? Why can the minister not say, well, listen, I get a bus or I get a train roughly once a week or once a month? It's just this broad, meaningless statement from the department in terms of how John travels, where he uses public transport when he can.
Irrelevant.
Well, using public transport when he can, how often is that? It doesn't affect his security by saying, well, look, I use a bus or a train once a month, once a week. But he just doesn't. He doesn't tell us. So we've just no idea. What we do know is he's saying he only goes into Belfast City Centre to his office twice a week in order to help with the congestion. Well, is that the message from the top? If you're working in Belfast City Centre, try to limit how much time you go in. The Chamber of Commerce would have a big problem with that. A massive problem with that.
Absolutely, and for many people, they can't limit you. If you're a shop worker or you work in hospitality, you can't. So what's the best thing that we can do to support them in the short term? Possibly one of the options is lower the bus fares, lower transport costs for 68 weeks.
I keep on, and we'll look at that too. I keep on coming back to government. Stormont has control here of a huge part of the workforce. So while they're asking people to do things, they could instruct a huge proportion of our workforce, all right, you are working a day from home, a day a week from home. Department of Infrastructure, when we said, well, is that what you're doing? They just said that a hybrid scheme. Again, they avoided giving the public specifics on that. What about the other government departments? What about Stormont coming together and saying, okay, all of the public service from now on, here's what will happen. Our permanent secretaries, for example, they will travel at least a day a week on a bus. Our leaders will do it. Our staff will be given an opportunity of working one day a week from home where it is possible to do so. None of this is happening. And there's all these broad statements while specifically asking the public, the little people, to do things. Gary in Castle Dawson. Morning, Gary.
Stephen, how are you?
Go ahead.
Stephen, there's a few points there listening to you this morning. The first is Minister O'Dowd, but not just Minister O'Dowd, any MLAs that need to go to London or any, they're not hard to travel on an airplane. We can travel with the public there, so if we start giving them private jets, don't understand how they can't use public transport. Boris Johnson used to cycle to work in London, never had a problem. And as for your buses, the 212 is probably one of the best recognised bus routes in Northern Ireland. It's very, very good, to be honest, except you can't get to the airport from Castle Dawson.
So what do?
You have to go to Belfast, get on another bus in Belfast and come right back to the airport.
Let me play you an idea that Chris Conway from Translink had when he was speaking to when he was speaking about, you know, maybe creating more space on the road and car parking charges. This is Chris Conway from Translink when he was speaking to Evening Extra yesterday.
Well, at the minute, it's Belfast is one of the lowest car parking charges in the UK. And obviously that is attracting people into the city and making it more difficult as well. A lot of that is on-street parking, which could be freed up for better road space for vehicles.
So you'd like to see parking charges go up in Belfast?
No, I'm not going to give you that headline, Declan.
I think you just did, Chris. So
Declan, I was very clear. I said it's a package of measures and you have to look at all of the measures together.
I understand that. And I'm not trying to be sensationalist about together. It.
So I'm not saying that car parking charges on their own is some sort of panacea. I'm not saying that.
I understand that. But that is one of the suggestions that you would like to make as part of a package.
It's one of the policy areas that could be looked at. I'm not suggesting it is as the chief executive of Translink. I'm just saying it's one of the areas, along with other policy areas as well.
So that's Mr. Conway speaking to Declan and Richard and Evening Extra yesterday. Gary, what do you make of that then? What about making Belfast a less welcome place to park?
To be honest with you, I say the 212 I use it a lot to go to Belfast. Brilliant service, and it's back home every half hour. My biggest problem is it comes out of Belfast too late or too early at night, so it's 10:30 or 11:00 is the last bus out of there. So it means then I have to take the car in if we're going for a meal or something like that. If I go to Liverpool or Manchester, I can buy an all-day ticket for the train and the bus for £6. And I travel all the time on that bus, so I can go to stadium tours, I can do everything on and off the bus. And as for your cycle lanes, I would love to know how much they actually spent on cycle lanes to the value where they could have started to extend train lines around Northern Ireland.
Meg Hoyt, Belfast Cycle Campaign. Good morning to you, Meg.
Good morning.
Well, look, we're scratching our heads as to why the department just won't tell us how many people are using the cycle lanes. Might be good news, might be bad news. We'll squeeze it out of them somehow. How important are they?
Cycle lanes are incredibly important. They're an absolutely vital piece of this puzzle in terms of how we get around our cities.
But they're not continuous, are they? So how do they work? So I haven't been on. I tried to get on a bike 3 or 4 years ago, and I'm serious. Yeah. The tire actually deflated so much under my weight. I got to the bottom of the driveway and turned back.
Right.
But how are they safe? How are they viable? If the cycle lanes, and I'm not being facetious here, I genuinely don't understand.
Mm-hmm.
So you decide to take your bike to work,
mm-hmm.
but the cycle lanes aren't continuous. So then you're on the road.
Yeah, so
what's
that
the point of having them in the first place if they don't go along the whole road?
Yeah, well, I would argue absolutely we agree here. So they need to be made continuous and they need to be made segregated and they need to be safe. And then you will see a transformation in how people travel around the city. So you're absolutely right. Currently, the one on the Dublin Road sort of ends abruptly at Shaftesbury Square and then you're suddenly in Shaftesbury Square on your bike. And so
you tiddle up that Dublin Road, right? It's not mm-hmm. that far. It's about 3-4 minutes up the Dublin mm-hmm. Road on a bike.
I used it this morning.
Right? Yep. You get into mm-hmm. Shaftesbury Square and all of a sudden the cycling lane initiative, kaput, it's gone.
Absolutely. So it needs to be extended, not reduced. Right? The lack of connected infrastructure puts people off cycling. You yourself have said it, right? You're nervous, you're scared, you don't know how long the cycle lane is going to last.
I'm not nervous. I'm too fat.
Well, I don't believe that. Cycling's for everyone, Stephen. So this needs to be a continuous network. It needs to be properly invested in. And then you'll see, as other cities have, a real change in how people get around the city.
So are they asking people to consider getting on a bike when they haven't got effective cycle lanes?
Yeah, I mean, the cycle campaign is quite frustrated with the pace of change and the pace of investment in active travel infrastructure from DfI. And you're exactly right. They're saying, get on your bike, wear your high-vis, wear your helmet, but we're not going to help you. You know, it's sort of every person for themselves out there on the road. So DFI absolutely needs to properly invest in active travel, and it needs to pick up the pace on the connected cycle network plans that we have. We've had for 10 years.
But to be fair to the minister, he doesn't have the money. And he would be the first to say, no doubt, if he spoke to you, he'd be the first to say, look, if only I had the money.
But this is some of the most affordable infrastructure you're going to build around the city. Right. It is really, cycling infrastructure is great value for money. Roads aren't. So take some of that money and invest. And actually, the Climate Change Act that we recently got 2 years ago, I think, mandates that 10% of the infrastructure budget is supposed to be spent on active travel. So, you know, DFI really needs to step up there when it comes to spending and investing in active travel.
The cost of updating our road network is $3 billion. That figure was released start of the month. $3 billion. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you can expect a lot of this minister, but society, our community and Stormont has got to fund his department if you want these things to happen.
Mm-hmm.
He can't do it with his hands tied behind his back.
Sure. But again, some of that money needs to be diverted to active travel. It is some of the most cost-effective infrastructure you are ever going to put into your city. Because unlike with a roads budget, active travel impacts other budgets. So the more people who cycle, the better their mental and physical health is. The more people who cycle, the less pollution we have in our cities. So investing in active travel is actually a positive gain for other departments, if that makes sense. Whereas investing in roads is not.
Okay, Meg, thank you very much. Again, loads and loads of calls this morning. My goodness, if they want to storm into a discussion about this, so many of you interacting with us, 0303 80 55 55. Let's come back to the MLAs at Stormont who have voted to continue with post-Brexit trade arrangements for another 4 years. The loyalist activist Jamie Bryson lost a legal challenge on the eve of the vote, claiming it had no legitimacy. So the arrangements continue, and the court says, Jamie, that your legal challenge failed.
Absolutely. And what the court said, what I went to the court to do was I ran the case on the basis that the DUP and the government announced the Safeguarding the Union deal. They said they had secured constitutional safeguards, constitutional legislation. That's what Geoffrey Donaldson told us. That's the basis upon which the DUP went back. And I simply went to the court on the basis of that legislation to test it and said to the court, well, this is what the government said this legislation does. And Mr Justice McAlinden said, well, no, why is the government potentially throwing breadcrumbs at people, only confusing issues? And as a matter of fact, this legislation has no material legal effect at all. So what the legal case has done has flushed out that all of the claims which the DUP based their return to Stormont on were completely and utterly false. And, you know, ironically, I went to court and almost argued against myself because I was the person, along with Jim Allister and others, who was arguing, saying, this legislation is nonsense. It has no effect. But I went to court and taken it up what the DUP said and said, no, this legislation does have effect. And the court says, no, it doesn't. Well, it does not do what they said that it did.
Well, the new leader of the DUP, Gavin Robinson, you know, he was using language like admitting that they oversold it. So he has distanced himself,
sorry,
hasn't he?
I mean, how can anybody not distance the outlandish, nonsensical claims made by Sir Geoffrey Donaldson? But let's remember, Gavin was standing on his shoulder when he was making those claims. He didn't tap him on the shoulder and say, Geoffrey, you're getting a bit carried away with yourself. They were all happy to go along with it to get back into Stormont. But in any event, let's take it where we are now. Gavin did try and walk it back a little bit. But then he said the Irish Sea border would be gone in the autumn. Now, it's ice cold. There's a polar bear outside. It's the winter. The Irish Sea border is not gone. It's more pleasant than ever. So where is the direction that Gavin Robinson promised? He promised, he said, there will be a direction coming to stop checks which are on goods going from Great Britain to Northern Ireland instead. Now, that will be coming in the autumn. And they made much of saying, we have got the commitment of the Labour Party as well to this. What is it? Because the Irish Sea border, far be it from softening, is actually hardening by the day. So the DUP... What the court case has done has flushed out all of the claims as a matter of law the DUP made as being completely false.
And yet they are the biggest unionist party in Northern Ireland. And yet, and this is anecdotal, Jamie, but when I look at the volume of people contacting this programme about traffic and congestion and about that bread and butter issue, I can tell you now it's massive. And there are very few people up in arms contacting this radio programme. And do you feel that momentum even in society among the unionist community about an Irish Sea border, which both you and Doug Peter are saying has grown? The public are not, the unionist community is not up in arms about it, no matter how hard you try.
Well, that's interesting because people like you said that back in 2019, before Stormont collapsed and the DUP were forced to collapse Stormont. I think all the polling shows that increasingly
The DUP's committed to not collapsing Stormont.
Yes, it's pathetic. It's utterly pathetic.
But they've got the democratic mandate to do it. And
Well, they had a democratic mandate and they stood on a democratic mandate that there'd be no power sharing until the Irish Sea border is gone. The DUP are now chief implementers of the Irish Sea border. They cannot get away from that. The executive, as a matter of law, have to implement the protocol. So the DUP are protocol Irish Sea border implementers. And whatever they say about that, that is the truth. And as Lord Dodd said in the House of Lords when they were going back, once you go back, you take ownership of this. It's yours now. And they have it. So the DUP own the Irish Sea border. It's their Irish Sea border. They have validated it.
And Northern Ireland continues, and you continue to have your British passport, and Lord Dodds continues to be in the DUP, and life goes on.
Well, so you may say, but Northern Ireland's place in the Union has been fundamentally subjugated, undermined by this Irish Sea border, and no self-respecting unionist should be in Stormont implementing that. It always should have been power sharing or the protocol, never both, but the DUP have given them both, and it's that's to their shame.
Jamie Bryson, thank you. So we're talking about lots today. We're talking about transport today. We're talking about Brexit today. We're going to be talking about the Welcome Centre, 030 30 80 55 55. Michael and Leslie Cairnduff, who run a County Down based pet food business we've seen in the news over recent days. Michael's with us this morning. Morning to you, Michael.
Morning, Stephen.
And here we are, you know, I was saying earlier to Doug Beattie, when people are talking about Articles 5 and 10 to 10 and all of this, you know, most people don't have a baldy clue what they're talking about. But you do, in terms of how paperwork is crucifying some small business, right?
Yeah, look, we're not alone. Almost 90% of business in Northern Ireland is micro and small business, like ourselves. Unfortunately, we deal with pet food, bringing it into Northern Ireland, that is deemed at risk. So it's a bit more onerous on us than most of the others, but they need to sort the system out, because your last contributor was saying about, or sorry, you were saying people weren't ringing in. The grace period for parcels runs out in March 25, so I suspect if all the Amazon deliveries stop in April, you may get rather more phone calls about this whole carry-on. We have a pretty good relationship, constructive relationship with DERA and the vets. Perhaps that's because we've made several complaints and offered our solutions to them. Don't know. But they are also complaining about the system being flawed and not fit for purpose. You know, forget about all the paperwork.
So give me a typical week or even a typical day. What is it doing to your business? Like practically, literally, what's it doing? What do you have to do?
Okay, look, there are a couple of improvements on the GB side, which has speeded up things. At its worst, we went from a 4-day pallet cycle to 10 to 12 days, working days I'm talking about. Okay. It's reduced back because GB side doesn't need a vet to come in and watch your iStack pallets. But on our side, after the Windsor framework came in, we went from the 40% under the Northern Ireland protocol to 100% inspection at one point port. It still hasn't gone back to the 40% that it was under the...
And when you talk about inspection at that report, what happens at that port?
The DERA inspectors need to check our pallet to make sure the manifest's right. But it should only be a 1 in 10 thing. It's currently every other pallet. That means you're talking about transport. Our groupage people that bring the big trailers in from GB, they're getting very fed up with us because we hold up all the other pallets on their trailer while it gets inspected.
So at some point in time, you might be worried, well, they'll just say it's not worth it. Or they'll put the price up to you.
Exactly. You know, Kyle's a very decent guy. They're very good, very helpful. However, they can only take so much interruption, for want of a better term.
Naomi Long was on Good Morning Ulster this morning, and she largely says without the Windsor framework that, you know, lots of pet food businesses wouldn't have a business. I'll try to find the clip, but she was largely saying that.
This is part of the reason why we're going on to programmes like yourself, talking to your colleague John Campbell. We want to put it out there that there has to be a better way to implement this system. It's supposed to be lighter touch. Like, if this is a light touch Windsor framework, what the heck is the, you know, full-on version going to be like? So the independent review may well be our last chance to get a proper light touch system, risk-based. If we don't sell food in the EU, we are not going to start tripling our turnover to sell pet food into Dundalk. That's not happening. So, like, we should be waved through. And if we open then a shop in Dundalk or somewhere, then we should rightly have to jump through another series of hoops with the EU. But at the moment, okay, you've heard of the Trusted Trader Scheme?
Yeah.
Okay, so we are a member of that Trusted Trader Scheme, but they don't blooming well allow us to trade without all these unnecessary risks on a low, sorry, checks on a low-risk business.
Well, why if you're part of that Trusted Trader Scheme?
Exactly. And then my question to people above you and I, why? What's the sense in being in the Trusted Trader Scheme if that doesn't mean something to allow us to trade?
I think, Michael, one of the questions certainly in my mind is when they're talking about this review, right, there mm-hmm. can be two types of review. One can be where they're ticking a box and it's reviewed and nothing changes and there's no intent to change anything. And the other is a review where there is the absolute intent to listen to genuine concern and genuinely do as much as you can to improve things. Now, the question is, which review are we getting?
That's a very good question, Stephen. And I would strongly suspect you're much better placed to find an answer to that than I am. But I would like to stick my oar in, give the feedback and try to make this as seamless as possible. And look, the guys in Deira are pulling their hair out because they are the ones that everybody's screaming at. And, like, most of them are trying to do their best.
Final question, are you optimistic?
We have to be, Stephen, otherwise I would have no hair left. Like but I do think this is pretty much the last chance saloon. Look, London and Brussels have much bigger trade things than Oscar Petfoods to worry about. On the other hand, you know, if we don't work towards a solution ourselves, they're not going to hand it to us.
What do you say to the DUP?
Look, politics is the art of the possible. So we need to look at what is possible and we need to implement it and make it as seamless as possible for the 90% of the business community in Northern Ireland that are small and micro enterprises.
Look, Michael, we'll stay with you along this and we'll be back to you and let's see what the review turns out and let's see where we are in 2025. Thank you very much for talking to us this morning.
You're welcome. Thanks for your time.
Thanks, Michael.
Cheers, Matt.
Morning to you.
Bye.
Look, on the Nolan Show, we've talked a lot, haven't we, over the years about homeless people and what they're experiencing on the streets. And we've spoken quite often to Jude White from the Welcome organisation, and he's in the studio with me this morning. Morning to you, Jude.
Good morning.
We were talking to you. Morning, Jude. We were talking, and it wasn't a very nice conversation, was it? It was a couple of months ago about you losing the building that you had been in, and you're here to announce this morning you've got a new one.
Yeah, we were talking, I suppose, last July, and it was a pretty, you know, it was a pretty dark day personally. It was a pretty dark day for the sector, I think, in Belfast. And I think I made an appeal then, you know, to some of the churches, to some volunteers. And I'm delighted to say that the Salvation Army, the good old Sally Ann, the bedrock of so many city centres, looking after the, you know, the vulnerable people, they have given us a bespoke support hub, a lot smaller than the one we had, but it has two or three things that are very, very important. One, it's we're not near or in a community, so that has taken that stress out of, you know, the community not wanting us there for very valid reasons, by the way. I mean, we totally acknowledge that.
You were shocked when you heard some of those callers talking to you on the Nolan Show that morning.
Absolutely. And when I reflected on it and asked people, I mean, if people are honest, we all care terribly about what we see in Belfast, but we don't want it in our garden or in our street corner. And I accept that. And I think we've made our peace with the community. We have closed that part of our operation down, and we're now around. The Salvation Army is quite a unique location in the city. It's in the city, but it's not in the city, for one. You know, you've got to cross there at the bottom of Ann Street, and you go across to their main building. While it's very, very central, it's not near any traders, any businesses, and it's not near any community. So, I mean, 10 out of 10, and I thank them this morning for, you know, for what they've done. And we are already in there. Our staff are in there. It's warm. It's clean. It has toilet facilities, washing facilities, and it has cooking facilities. Although we bring most of the food.
So that's a support. There are two different locations here we're going to talk about this morning, not specifically, but that support hub will help, what, 15 to 20 people?
It will help 15 to 20 people at a time. And what we're going to try and do is put more structure, because there are more than 15 to 20 people in and around the streets of Belfast. We would have had 60 maybe people using our what was then a drop, and we're changing the model to a support hub. So we're going to have to get a bit more structure. And while, again, a 10 out of 10 to the Sally Ann, this is a temporary place, and we will be looking for somewhere bigger. We had a place in Lower Donegal Street, but it was totally inappropriate. And again, I suppose I need to acknowledge and thank the traders of Lower Donegal Street, although they did make my life very, very stressful. We're out of there very, very soon, and you can get back to doing what you do best, which is getting on with your business. So that's a really good news story.
I can hear you kind of grappling and acknowledging the tension that is built into this, which quite frankly can be summed up with most decent people. Their hearts go out to these homeless people, but they don't want them anywhere near them. And look, that sounds crass me saying it, but I'm trying to just call it.
Well, Stephen, I mean, you don't miss a wall, and I won't either. That is brutally honest. It's brutally true. And, you know, handing somebody a pound or a sandwich, I suppose, makes us feel a wee bit better, and we might sleep a wee bit better in our bed. I haven't slept in about 3 years. In fact, do you know what the Northern Ireland Housing Executive and me have in common? I met Grania Long and Jennifer Hall, two fine, decent civil servants, and we all agreed we haven't slept in years, because you go to bed thinking, what if? You dream then about homelessness and addiction, and you get up in the morning and you think about it again. And that's brutally true what you've said, and it needs to be called. I'm glad you did.
I've had the opportunity in recent times to be out late at night, overnight, in Belfast City Centre in the cold. And I didn't quite realise it until I saw it myself, that your centre, the Welcome Centre, is so embedded into the fabric of help for the PSNI, that when the PSNI are out and they're coming, they're sitting down to a human being. They're at that level. They're down on the ground on their hands and knees to a human being, who clearly may freeze to death, who clearly is in trouble. First thing they're saying is phone the Welcome. You're completely embedded in saving lives in this country. I've seen it. I can say it because I've seen it. And then the other thing, I just indulge me for a moment here. Like I'm around this place. What, I'm 51, broadcasting nearly 30 years here. It's only recently that I have realised, as a citizen here, the nightly terror that there is in homeless people, in the eyes, in the faces of homeless people, as they huddle together sometimes to try to keep warm, as some of them are desperately reliant on someone like you or your organisation to bring them a sleeping bag, to bring them food. And some of these people are terrified, absolutely terrified. And then they're fighting drug addiction, as you know. And what do we do to them? We expect them to break those addictions, survive in the freezing cold and wet, and somehow do all of that without a roof over their head. Like they're beat.
Well, I mean, that's very graphically illustrated what you've said. Our job is to, I mean, our whole philosophy is street to home. We are, of course, we'll give out sleeping bags. Of course, we'll give out food and shelter and toiletries and washing facilities. But the objective is to get people off the street and into proper tenancies, into proper housing. And, you know, I suppose the context of this can't be ignored. I mean, it's on your programme, it's on Crawley, it's everywhere. We are in the middle of, the biggest single issue facing this society is not Brexit. It's not the constitutional question. It's not all of this bloody nonsense. The biggest single crisis facing this society is housing. That is the core of any civilised society. We have went from 30,000 up to 50,000 people now who are deemed in some way homeless. And that, of course, there aren't 50,000 people lying on the streets, but they are in substandard accommodation. They're living with their parents well into their 30s and 40s. They are renting poor accommodation. They're surface sofing, etc., etc., etc. So the context is, and I mean, I think we always want to blame somebody, don't we? I mean, let's blame the housing executive. I'm not going to do that. The housing executive that I know and the supporting people I know are fine, decent civil servants who, like myself, don't sleep a lot. And then it goes up to, I suppose, the department. You can criticise Gordon Lyons all you want. He came down to see us within a week. Fine fella. Shy fella in many ways. And he lived up to his promise. He helped us. You know, the central budgets that we deal with, we are not in control of. And if there were, I suppose, tomorrow 30, 40,000 houses built, would this problem go away? It probably wouldn't, because what you've touched on there is addiction is, and I mean, and you've articulated addiction about your own. And I mean, and so have I. I could have been lying on the streets myself. My life was blown apart in the 80s. I can remember 85, 86, 87, thinking the best way out of this is just to get blocked. It's just to get drunk. Yeah. But there was people there to support me.
And after the murder of your mother.
Yeah, that's what we're trying to do here. We're trying to offer support. Will we ever get everybody from the street into the home? We won't. Because, believe it or not, there are a small number of people, a very small number of people who choose a lifestyle because they find a hostel life maybe too stressful. They're afraid of sexual violence. They're afraid of being assaulted, etc. But by and large, the energy in this city to deal with this problem is overwhelming. and it's positive. And the staff who work, certainly for the Welcome organisation and many others, Simon DePaul and for Paul McCusker's, there are no words to describe these people. They are angels sent from heaven. They get paid very, very little. I'm embarrassed actually looking at some of them sometimes at the amount of money I have to pay them. And they go out all day, every day, 365 days a year. We're on the streets from 7 in the morning to 2 the following morning.
So your centre, as we said at the top of this, you were asked to leave the local community because of the reasons we've discussed, and you've found a new building. We're not going to say where it is, but it's in South Belfast. Tell us about this new building.
We are going to, over the next 3 or 4 months, and this is a tall order of a commitment, I suppose. I hope to be able to say to you by Easter that there will never be another young woman or girl has to sleep on the streets of Belfast if they choose not to. That's our objective. We are committed to women's services.
This is a women's only building, is it?
It's a bespoke building. It's 26 rooms. We have shower facilities. It's going to be staffed. And it's going to be 24 hours. It's going to be a therapeutic community. We've got to move away.
That's amazing. That's a hell of an announcement.
It is, yes. We have got to move away from this notion of drop-in and hostel life. Nobody wants to live in a hostel. People want their own front door. Nobody really wants to drop in to anywhere with no objective, no plan, no outcome. This can be tackled. And it can be tackled with some sensible partnership and cooperation. And I think this city should be very proud of the fact that we at last are going to make this step, that nobody will be left behind here if they choose not to be left behind.
You're going to be peed off at me asking this question, right? But it's in my head. So you're announcing this morning this women's only facility. Why is it not for men too? And why is there not a men's only facility? Like, why do women get this priority?
Historically, nobody would ever believe, certainly my mother's, and I suspect your mother's here, nobody would ever believe women even drank. Never mind, they were never seen in pubs. Historically, Belfast has a multitude of hostels, for men and for men only. And, you know, they are festooned around the city in Sandy Row, East Belfast, the Lower Falls. They're at the Salvation Army. So there isn't actually a massive problem with male-only hostels. The women's hostels in this town are overwhelmingly connected to domestic violence. And, you know, again, the unspoken heroes of this town, Women's Aid, have a number of hostels here that are kept quite confidential, where women who have been assaulted or are victims of physical or psychological violence and go to. The big gap here has been, and it's, I suppose it's been a reluctance for people to even acknowledge that women could possibly have alcohol problems or could possibly have drug problems. I mean, people of our era, of my era, and I'm a lot older than you, Stephen, addiction was guys like you and me. We small, overweight, middle-aged men lying in Castle Street or North Street with a bottle of Mundy's and a fish supper. That's gone. This town is festooned with drugs.
Yeah, I can see it.
It's everywhere.
I can see it. I was standing at 2 a.m., 2, 3 a.m. a few weeks ago in a well-known place where people inject and things in the middle of the night. There was this guy, and he was trembling so much from the cold, and he came up to me and he said to me, I worked with your mum. I looked at him, and I am embarrassed to say this, but my instant thing was, sorry, there wasn't a cocaine addict working with my mum, because what I did was I dehumanised him, and I feel so guilty about that. And I looked at him, and this guy had a half hour conversation with me of how he didn't want to go back to the hostel because they were injecting drugs in that hostel and he was trying to stay out of them. So he was standing in the freezing cold trying to beat his cocaine addiction with someone like me, an idiot like me, with all the prejudice built in. Someone like you wouldn't be anywhere close to my mum.
Yeah, so it'd be awful. It's unthinkable.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, and that's I mean, again, you've touched on the issue, and contrary to what people may think, addiction is not a lifestyle choice. My own father, some of my family, and my own family have been polluted with addictions over the years. These are your brothers, sisters, your ma's, your dad's, your grannies. You know that strange auntie or that strange uncle that was never quite right or wasn't around and seemed at Christmas to be off the radar for a few. These are your family. They are the citizens of this city, and we owe them something to help them.
Tell me more about this centre. You must be excited.
Of course we are, but as an organisation, we are totally committed to women's services, and we're totally committed to making that reality, that no women or no young girls will ever have to sleep on the streets of Belfast again. It'll be a therapeutic community. It will be intensively staffed. It will annoy nobody. And I mean, I promise you, and I mean, I know I reflect the wonderful people that I work with and the board, that we have made this a reality. We literally have got off our knees, because I did feel last summer when I talked to you, I actually talked to you from Poland, as you observed, when I was on my holidays. I actually thought at that time, maybe it's time to merge, maybe it's time to hand these contracts back. And, you know, today I feel very, very positive. And I mean, last night, for example, just it's in my pocket here right now. Last night, a guy came up to me and he said to me, "Are you Jude White?" And I said, "Aye," expecting a punch in the back. And he handed me that envelope, which I opened this morning. Total random. I don't even know who he is. And 500 quid. And I'm going round today.
My goodness.
To give it to Kieran, our fundraiser guy.
My goodness.
500 quid. You know, people might give you 20 or 40. 500 quid. So, you know, that is the sort of stuff that this organisation needs. And that's not to belittle the faith-based groups or people who do the hot food and the soup and the sandwiches, etc. That's the sort of resources we need.
Yeah. And this new centre opens next month, right?
Soon.
Soon.
And you'll be the first to know. I'll give you a heads up.
I want to come round and have a look if I can.
We'll have you up. Sure, you can become a patron of the organisation. That'll get us into all sorts of bother. But I imagine it'll get us a few pounds.
Don't make me laugh. I'm not well. All right. Listen, thank you for what you do. It's amazing what you do. And I can say that because I see the people that are benefiting from it and rely on you. So thank you very much, Jude.
Cheers. Thank
and
you.
And Jude announcing this morning the opening of a new hostel facility for women, 26 rooms, and it will be opening soon. Thank you, Jude.
The biggest show in the country. Listen again on BBC Sounds. Tweet at Stephen Nolan. Stephen Nolan Show!